Those microphones are working. I'll start from here. Welcome to, thank you, Professor, for the lecture. I welcome my guests to the main discussion for this morning, is ethical conduct of science. It's a very hot topic. It's been discussing with past 2 days here and in the corridors, at the sessions, different during the lunch, during the dinners. And I'm very happy to be joined by Professor Indira Nath from Indian Academy of Sciences, with Kreisha Abdul Karim from Caprisa, South Africa, with Cheko Asakawa, IBM Research Fellow from IBM, Li Zhenshan, Professor from the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and Professor Michael Saliba from Technical University of Darmstadt and representative of the Young Academy of Sciences. Also, welcome Professor Hendricks. For start, I would like to ask you, Professor Hendricks actually gave us a very good introduction with her keynote lecture and raised so many questions and dilemmas. Can you tell me what was the question that was going on in your minds during these couple of days, Professor Indira? Could you start?
Is this working?
Yeah, it's working.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, I took a minute to understand the question. I would like to say, first of all, that I'm very appreciative of the fact that ethics... Is that better? Okay. Thank you. I would like to say that I'm very appreciative of the fact that the World Science Forum has put ethics as the, has flagged ethics as the major principle of science. Usually ethicists complain that we go to them after we've started the experiment or after we've started the work, except of course in the medical area where you need to go through an ethical committee. But so that way it is very important. But the questions that still come up in my mind, especially after the wonderful keynote address we've had, is equity. You know, how do we give equity, both gender-based? I hesitate to say gender-based because the committee has so many women, and this, I think the man is in the minority. But in general, let us face it, that in my country particularly, I find a lot of girls joining research, and biomedical research particularly. But their future gets derailed a little bit when they get married. Mind you, the man also gets married, but it seems it affects the woman much more. And so equity of such people, and I think you've already raised the issue that we don't perhaps consult the right type of civil society who are the consumers of the science that we produce. So, and there is no doubt even in publications that you find that it's really mainly West-oriented, or as I'd like to say, empire-oriented. So the empire needs to strike back a little bit. So this kind of equity in science is something that bothers me.
Thanks, Malika. Good morning, everyone. So I was thinking about three things as I've been listening to various presentations and also specifically with Cheryl's presentation this morning. And the first is that science is not homogeneous. And when we think about the challenges that face us, some of those challenges are more immediate, some are distant. For example, for many years we thought about extraterrestrial research as something downstream for some of the threats that face us. But if we think about infectious diseases like an Ebola outbreak or HIV/AIDS, these are things that are very discipline specific and face us today. Some of them are global challenges, and even in a global challenge, we may have disparities between more developed and industrialized countries and less developed and industrialized countries. So sometimes, even though we may want to take a global perspective on an issue, our actions need to be informed by what is going on locally. And when we think about the use of science to address these challenges, whether we're working as a global community or we're responding locally, we cannot ignore some of the disparities that exist between us, industrialized and non-industrialized countries. But I think ultimately what we're trying to do is leave the world a better place. And the benefactors from our research very rarely feature. So we talk about policy, but we do need to engage civil society. We do need to engage those individuals who we want to benefit from our research very early on in the process. And I call this the nexus between science and activism. And I'll use the example of HIV/AIDS, where I'm more familiar with how those early days of seeing AIDS, the inevitably fatal result of being infected with HIV, even before we knew what the cause of AIDS was, drove large numbers of people who were witnessing young friends, colleagues, and people close to them dying, and yet the science was not responding equally. And that really pushed the rate at which knowledge was being generated. And again, when we had the knowledge to transform AIDS from an inevitably fatal condition to one that was manageable and chronic, it took activism again and global solidarity to ensure that everybody in the world, regardless of where you are, who, if you're infected, you all get the same treatment on diagnosis. So these are examples where we have problems. We, through global solidarity, have been able to make advances and complete the cycle of getting the science to the community. And I think that when we think about science, ethics, and responsibility, it's like, what are our biggest challenges? Two is that science is a slow process. You're not going to get a quick answer. But three, that we have to engage those who will benefit, not just policymakers. And we've got to get the policymakers involved early as well. Thank you.
Good morning. So I want to talk about, based on my experiences and through my field. And later in my presentation, I'm going to share more, you know, examples. But at this moment, I want to say, like, you know, technology has been evolved rapidly, much, much faster than ever after AI has been appeared. Let me give you some example. I'm visually impaired, and now I can expect AI will see the world for me and understand the world for me and interpret it for me. However, we need data to make it better, to make it real, and to make it practical. But as you all know, it's very, very difficult. We cannot collect the data as much as we need. It's maybe because of ethics, guidelines, regulations, privacy, but the most importantly, lack of social acceptance or social societal understanding. We need to let people know, understand how technology can help you, help improve your quality of lives. So to do that, we need education and the awareness. Throughout the education, people will understand, you know, you don't have to too much worry about the privacy, security, because researchers and developers are protecting it. However, you know, people tend to think about, oh, no, I don't want to be recorded. It may hurt my privacy or something like that. So such misunderstanding will, you know, slow down the evolvement of technology. So I really hope, you know, we can discuss new ways of ethical conduct of science in the new AI era. Thank you.
Thank you very much. What struck me the most in the past few days was, and in this presentation as well, was the willingness to interdisciplinarity, so that more subjects need to come together. For example, my research is on new materials. We're trying to work on solar cells, which is a very technical subject on one hand. On the other hand, it needs to also take economic considerations into account as well. And that's a subject area that isn't close to my heart as a physicist, let's say, from the beginning. But only by going hand in hand with other subjects, it's possible to have a holistic implementation of something important as clean energy implementation, which is one of the SDGs as well. So that's one aspect, the interdisciplinarity and the breaking of silos, and it seems the academic tribes are coming together very nicely here. The second thing that struck me specifically about the World Science Forum is that we are here in Hungary, in the Hungarian Academy of Science. And they are under attack, in a way, by the government at the moment. There is a huge power struggle on who owns science in that sense, on who can advocate the scientific method. And it's extremely politicized at the same time as well. And I'm very impressed, despite all the budget cuts, despite all the struggle that they have here in the Hungarian Academy of Science, that they are still managing to keep the spirit up, that there's still like a very vibrant and alive culture of science here that enables this forum, and that really impresses me deeply. Thanks.
Hey, 大家好。
Hello, everyone. My English is not that good.
Please put on your headphones. Please.
It is a great privilege for me to be here. My English is not that good, but I feel so grateful that the organizing committee gave me this chance to communicate with all of you. I'm a researcher from the Chinese Academy. The main field of my research for the past 10 years is the emerging technology development, as well as its law, legislation, and ethical aspects. The report I brought today is about the ethical relationship between global perspective and local perspective. This is the dilemma of the ethics, and I will talk more details later. I was very inspired by the keynote speech. Professor Hedrick mentioned the democratic negotiation. This is what I'm so interested in, but it met some dilemma and difficulty. What is the difficulty? The difficulty is that the ethics is always at the margin. It always decided by the interests. The other thing that I want to share with you is the review of the ethic. Mostly it is in the biosciences field and has a long history. But in artificial intelligence, for example, Google company funded a review committee of ethics, but it was dismissed for a short time. So this is the question that I'm concerned with, the ethics of the artificial intelligence. Thank you.
Professor Nutt, could you give us your presentation now? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Malika, and the panel. And I'm really honored to be talking on ethical conduct of research. I thought when I saw the presentations, and Dr. Lee and I were partners in one of the committees where we addressed the issues on research. And so I thought I would look mainly at research and look at the global responsibility since this is a World Science Forum. So there has been, as all of you are very aware, a growing interest both amongst the scientists as well as the public about research integrity around the world. And this is mainly because we've had lots of high-profile cases of irresponsible research. So it's really the negative aspects of research that brought attention of the public to what is happening in science. And this is a bit dangerous because a lot of good things, as we know, are happening in science, but we are perhaps not communicating as much as the misuse of science. And therefore, the academies of the world and some of the national academies got together to see how we could correct this issue. And these are the sort of policy reports that were brought up. And as I said, Dr. Lee and I were partners in this. And when we look at, as one of the panel members mentioned, that science is a broad word and it includes all kinds of disciplines and transdisciplinary approaches and emerging technologies. So when you start looking at the values of research or the what are the values of research that we can recommend, it became very clear that each discipline has its own specialized ethics and which are followed very well. And so we investigated what would be the core values of research that go across all behavior patterns in these disciplines. And really, it comes down to very simple statements of seven global values that we identified, as you see on the board. And that's honesty, fairness, objectivity, reliability, skepticism, accountability, and openness. And we felt that this would cover most disciplines. The whole problem has been that in the recent emerging technologies, as Dr. Lee was emphasizing, the artificial intelligence story, but really what's exciting everyone recently, and we've had the second summit of human genome editing in Hong Kong in December, And that is the research, the ethical implications of some of the biomedical emerging technologies that's happening. Mitochondrial donation is one of those which now has babies with three parent chromosomes or genetic information in them. And this, of course, is extremely good for taking care of those diseases which are transmitted by maternal transmission. And it has raised a lot of ethical and spiritual questions in various cultures as to whether this should be undertaken. And in UK, it has been permitted up to a point. Then comes the really exciting story of the human genome editing and the CRISPR. And the CRISPR technologies, which we, I think, had a session yesterday about. And now here the implications again go across the cultures. And as the map shows, that at present we don't have really a unified regulations or concepts on how the embryo should be handled or how we tackle the in vitro fertilization after the embryo has been edited. So many countries have no rules or have no control over this, and some countries have fairly strong rules. So in general, it appears more that embryo implantation after editing is something that people have more or less banned in most countries. But working on embryos and editing them up to a point, 14 days or so, is still permissible, and you go through very rigid regulations of various national ethical committees for this. But it again brings out the point that not all the countries and not all the cultures are in the same wavelength where this technology is, how it should be regulated and how we should handle it. Then comes the question of how do we do research with, as already mentioned, with robotics, with machine learning, and especially the deep machine learning is sometimes a bit worrying, and then artificial intelligence, which has already come into health for diagnostics and robotic surgery. And the more important aspects of it, I think, are going to be discussed by the other speakers. But for me, the worrying is that it's very good for life-saving of remote areas, and it's being used also in India for mainly that kind of medicine, diagnostics in remote areas, etc. But the worrying aspect is, of course, the prone to hacking as far as health instrumentation goes. The other aspects, of course, of robotics is, do we now come into an era of what we call cyborg? So the cyber component and the health component are getting really very close to each other, and no longer are they really separate as such. There is one individual who, as Alexander would have said, uses DIY, do-it-yourself story. He has a muscular disease which makes him very weak. So he's replacing parts of his body slowly. We, of course, know Stephen Hawking, who used for his vocal cords a machine. But this gentleman has not only used his vocal cords, but he's replaced part of the esophagus, which cannot swallow, and parts of his colon, which is defective. So in other words, part by part, he's been able to, and with the help of good biomaterials as well as artificial intelligence component, been able to replace those parts that are defective, and that makes him live well because his brain is working beautifully. So the question then comes of how, of course, it's very expensive at the moment, but as we know, everything gets cheaper as time goes on. Mobiles were so expensive and now they're so cheap. So how do we handle this kind of thing? And are we happy of having a human who's partly a machine. So one of the things I think a forum like this can do is concentrate on what could be, or at least focus a little bit, on global harmonization and research practices. So how do we improve the quality and accessibility, which is very important, of research data? There's a lot of data in data banks which are still not accessible to people and to researchers, and we need to protect these data banks, and we need to get a common pattern for the data bank so that anyone with any other language can also access them. The other responsibility which I find myself very important are the journal editors in publishing research. And here, since finally the research gets recognized by public or by other scientists only when it is published. If it remains just in a lab, it doesn't get the same kind of communication. And therefore, the journal editors have a very serious job to do in sorting out what is real and what is misused and what is fake. And as the keynote speaker, Cheryl, said, plagiarism and image manipulation, which has become very common now. And this kind of a thing is their responsibility. The worrying aspect also is we've made digital and online publishing now a practice, which has been very useful, especially for countries from developing countries. But on the other hand, it's also led to predatory type of journals, which are coming up, mainly because the policies of the nation demand that to get a good job, you need to have more publications. So for the academics, having the number of publications becomes important, and then they tend to use these predatory journals, which are really, as Trump would say, fake news. So it's very important that we have a global view on this. And then the other thing that bothers me, as I said, is equity, and that is collaboration, both interdisciplinary as well as international collaboration. We need to improve that kind of an environment and harmonize the approaches as far as possible with global peer reviews of research funding, et cetera. So it raises the question, do we need to now change our approaches a little bit? And since the World Science Forum has been such an influential body, maybe it should not end up as just a talk shop where we all meet and we are like-minded people, we are worried about similar things, and therefore we talk and we feel very pleased. I think the time has perhaps come when we need to show something and do something that will help in this kind of global harmonization. And I've been wondering whether we need an international forum that can identify the latest developments and foresee the temptations of misuse, as Dr. Lee was mentioning in her short talk. And I think this is something that we should really perhaps think of, if I may be bold enough to say. One of the suggestions made was that of a Nuclear Threat Initiative Group, which is an NGO based in Washington. And they've suggested that we have a sort of an accreditation, which is really a seal of approval. And so the debate we had in Geneva last month was, should we have such a seal of approval for accreditation of institutions who practice good behavior? And the question is, should we really reward good behavior? And I think the time has perhaps come that we do reward good behavior, even though good behavior should be the norm of every scientist. But there is no harm in recognizing that certain institutions are practicing really good behavior. And perhaps then we need that kind of an accreditation. And the debate can go on as to whether it should be institutions that get a seal of approval or whether it's investigators who get it. So these are some of the the two main things that I was thinking is the need of the hour. One is an independent forum which can foresee, if it's possible, to predict the future of emerging technologies, but at least they can see what are the latest developments, as Dr. Lee was mentioning, and then perhaps appreciate those institutions which are following good practices. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor. As Professor Nutt actually made an introduction, we can ask Professor Zhenzhen to join us and give us her presentation, please.
Before I came here, I did a lot of work, but now accepted the reality that I have to speak in Chinese, because if I speak in English, none of you would understand me. Just now I mentioned the dilemma of ethics. A more obvious and clearer perspective of the ethics is the global perspective and the local perspective. The differences between culture results in the confliction. I would like to talk about the evolution of the science history in introduction. I want to say this because to build a positive relationship between science and ethics is a very important part in today's science. And I would follow with the ethical dilemma. And at last, I would give you some conclusion. So let's see the evolution of the science. From traditionally, the institutional goal of science is to increase new knowledge. So the highest state of a scientist is to pursue the truth. So whether in science or for scientists, knowledge is a whole embodied. From the 1980s, the scientific change and development has gained great progress, and many scientists have researched about this part and gave a lot of concepts. Whatever the concept is, we can see the description that the systematic regulation and goal of science have already changed. It is not only to gain the knowledge, but also to capitalize the knowledge. The capitalization of knowledge
is
In the past, the pursuit of truth is our main goal, but the capitalization of knowledge now is also another part of the motivation of scientific research. It used to be biased and blamed. So this leads to the disparity of the science and ethics, and that's why we need to think about the relationship between science and ethics today. The scientific ethics has already overpassed the field of science and already entered into social field and the policy making. In fact, the construction of the positive relationship between ethics and science is an inside development. The ethical regulation of science is a strategy to achieve a positive relationship between ethics and science. So let's look at the dilemma we are facing right now. Ethics has already been an important part of the science. But one phenomenon we need to focus is that ethics in different levels and perspectives is different. That means the conflation of interests and the ethics. And hereby, I would like to raise a question of the global perspective and the local perspective. So we will be faced with a situation. The ethical requirement raised for the all human kind usually cannot be implemented by a specific country or culture. For example, the atomic bombs. Or the climate change issues. Different countries have different actions towards this issue. Or it is difficult for us to prevent robotics from being used for actions aimed at improving national military power. Or to stop the use of the new biotechnology to create super babies. So these things may be consistent with ethics in local perspective, but it is not right and correct from a global perspective. So as a result, we are caught in an ethical dilemma. Under the increasingly global competition, the local ethics is difficult to solve global problems. And the ethics at the level of humanity has become a utopia. Therefore, the question we need to consider and to discuss now is that when the science and technology has already brought us benefits as well as the risks, how and to what extent we should solve local problems from the ethical dimension. I mentioned the democratic negotiation just now. Now we are using this method to dissolve the problem. It is effective, but it is only from a strategic level. So in my will, we should discuss more and deeper about this issue, and we should discuss the ethical conduct of science from the perspective of the science for the welfare of human being. Ethical science is still a marginal discipline in science. And this is the problem that we need to solve. When the technology has become a main factor to decide our development today, it is an important question to think about. Thank you.
I would like to ask Gureisha Abdulkarim to give us her presentation. It's a different field of science research and ethics.
Thank you very much, Melika. Good morning again. Thank you very much for locating my slides. Good morning again, and I want to start by thanking the Hungarian Academy of Science for their warm hospitality in hosting us, and also for the World Academy of Science for the opportunity for me to address you this morning. And I want to pick up from the previous speakers in terms of looking at ethical conduct of science, and from my earlier comments to pick up on the nexus between science and advocacy and what can we learn from HIV/AIDS. Now, I think that we are all talking about artificial intelligence, and we're talking about some common principles with which we can leave this deliberation and that we've been having for the past several days. And I think that's a wonderful aspirational goal. But as we set up these aspirational guidance and values and ethics by which we will conduct our research and how we use science to change society, I think it's important to remind ourselves about what is the history we're coming from and how can we learn from that history as we move forward. And I think that in the many transitions that are facing us today, there are some things that we have taken as ingrained in some of our scientific disciplines that machine learning and artificial intelligence is going to turn around. And you're going to hear from two other speakers about AI and machine learning. So I thought I'd just go back to some basic principles.
And we are, as individual scientists, part of a global community. But as individual scientists, we're also shaped by the societies we come from and influenced both globally and locally. I'm an infectious diseases epidemiologist. And by definition, epidemiology is about a scientific discipline that has in its definition the concept of social justice. So you can't simply observe epidemics that are unfolding, you have to act on it, even oftentimes with imperfect knowledge. And you have to continue to monitor the impact of those interventions and change and correct what you're doing as knowledge emerges and evolves. And I come from South Africa. I'm a third generation South African. And I was considered I'm still a black South African. And living in apartheid South Africa had a huge influence in terms of how I could practice as a scientist, what kind of scientist I would be, and what issues I focused on. So in immersed in communities that were bearing the brunt of the apartheid state, there resulted huge disparities along racial and ethnic lines. And anyone who tried to publish papers highlighting these disparities were forced into exile. In fact, the field of epidemiology was banned as a scientific field of study in South Africa, and there were no schools of public health until the 1990s. I trained as an epidemiologist in New York, I think in 1990, one of about eight epidemiologists that had sought to study epidemiology in Europe and America. Now, so if you think about it, and if you as an epidemiologist are working at a population level and want to bring about change to those that are so disadvantaged and vulnerable, one of the areas in terms of saving lives is health. And so a lot of my research is around biomedical research. And I want to say that as we think about ethics, the biomedical research field is perhaps the most highly regulated. But a lot of those regulations are less than a century old. They actually emanate from a variety of scandals. And in true human form, we take these scandals and then we intervene with guidance and we rear them in overprotectionism. And so some of those are the Nuremberg trials. We know about Tuskegee, and there's a whole long list that you've been hearing about. And central around these guidelines that have developed, that continue to evolve, is the concept of informed consent. So when you are taking part in a study of something experimental, are you fully informed that this is experimental, it doesn't work? And are you voluntarily consenting? So if you happen to be a poor person and seeking health care in a public sector health facility where access is free and at no cost, and you're suddenly confronted with a researcher, do you really have or perceive yourself as somebody who has very little rights, very little access to resources, in a position to voluntarily participate? Do you think that your healthcare will be compromised if you say no to that scientist who's trying to recruit you in a study there? So informed consent has been a big part of it, and we've spent several decades refining how do we get really true informed and voluntary consent from participants. And I'm raising this point because when we think about machine learning and artificial intelligence, we are moving like a 180 from these very detailed procedures that we have in place to one where definitions of privacy and confidentiality have been completely removed. So I'm not anti-tech. I see technology as an important way to leapfrog us, bridge disparities, etc. but also I think what it's putting on its head is traditional ways and traditional principles by which we have undertaken research. And then just to add that when we're working with experimental drugs, we have an additional layer of regulatory oversight. So we can't really go in and do whatever we want. But I should add that even though we have those protections in society, these checks and balances, they're not of even quality across the globe. And I have seen repeatedly where scientists search out those countries where these oversight mechanisms are not up to par, they're underdeveloped, and deliberately go and do research in those settings. Now, as I said, I come from a country and I grew up where there were severe disparities between those who were considered white or not white. And so in doing my research, I took careful consideration into how do I not perpetuate these human rights violations and how do I respect these vulnerable communities, and started to formulate this whole process of community engagement. And how do you include potential beneficiaries right from the questions that you're asking? Is that question of importance and significance in the communities that you're going to be working in? And how do you take that through the research process? And, you know, we do research because we don't have an answer. And sometimes I think when we get too caught up in randomized controlled trials and highest levels of evidence, we forget about common sense. If we know something is going to work, we use it. Research is when we really don't know, when we have equipoise that we are seeking to address the question in a robust and rigorous manner. So 9 times out of 10, you know, I'm the first one to call myself an expert at failing, because every time I'm trying to find something, a solution, or evaluate something, 9 times out of 10 it doesn't work out, even though I have built my research question on the existing body of knowledge to give it the biggest chance of success. So the question is, how quickly do we bring policymakers into these deliberations when the probability of success is so small? But I still think that as scientists, we're not here just to answer a specific question, say goodbye to the communities we're working with, or goodbye to the governments we're working with. That the part of our role and responsibility is to educate everybody, to bring everyone along with us. Why is it we're pursuing this idea? Why are we pursuing this idea in this specific way? And what would the potential outcomes be? Be prepared for that. So if, for example, you have that rare success, you're now not scrambling around to look, get a decision maker to listen to your results and have the decision maker suddenly think about policy and programming, etc. So one mechanism we have is a community advisory board that is established in the communities we work in, and they can be global, local, regional, etc., who are really nominated individuals who can be and speak for the voiceless and be the nexus between any concerns you're having with science. And I think that this notion of community engagement and partnership is something that's being put together in a more structured way. In the biomedical sciences, we have something called good participatory practices, which is very analogous to good clinical practices, which comes from the harmonization of clinical trial conduct. But there's also the CORED effort, which is very new, emerging, very promising, around research fairness initiative. And I think when we are talking about disparities, when we're talking about transitions, we need to make sure that whatever we do is fair. In the last few minutes, I just want to talk about this issue of the nexus between science and activism in the context of HIV. We can substitute this with any other infectious disease outbreak. We can put Ebola there. As soon as we have an infectious disease outbreak, so immediately everyone is thinking about protecting their own borders. And nobody is thinking about those who are sick and dying in large numbers. And what does that mean? So in a way, with our personal territorial protectionist approach, we end up creating stigma and discrimination, and we isolate further those who bear heavy burden in HIV. If you look here, is this situation where young people were dying in large numbers in industrialized countries, in Africa, and the response of activism in the US and in Europe was about pushing the science. And that led us to the discovery of HIV diagnostic tools and our ability then to move towards finding therapeutic and prevention tools. So if we think that we've turned the tide on the epidemic, I thought I should just share this with you, that today we have nearly 40 million people living with HIV. We have still about a million people dying, but significantly 1.6 million new infections, which roughly translates to 5,000 new infections each day. So there's not a country in the world that doesn't have HIV. It is global. But the distribution is uneven. 70% of these infections are in sub-Saharan Africa. I want to highlight here where when we discovered antiretroviral treatment, until 2002, only those who could afford antiretroviral treatment, triple therapy, were able to access it. It took finally in the 13th International AIDS Conference to be held in Africa to draw attention to the many millions of people dying every day from AIDS without access to these life-saving drugs. And here we saw global solidarity through the establishment of the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, Malaria, and also PEPFAR, and some governments investing in access. And suddenly we have 23 million people on treatment, and we're seeing the survival benefits of that. But prevention remains a challenge. As I mentioned earlier, Africa bears a disproportionate burden. You can see South Africa is their number one. Recently, we celebrated winning the World Cup in Japan for rugby. But this is the number one we don't like, where we have less than 1% of the global population, but one in five HIV infections. So global problem, but disproportionate burden in Africa. What do we know about the epidemic in Africa is that young women bear a disproportionate burden of infection. And this gives you some indication: by age 16, one in 10 women infected; by age 25, every other woman. And when we looked as local scientists, what we found was, here's the problem: young women acquiring infection 5 to 7 years before men, but a huge disconnect in terms of what is available to prevent infection. So we start looking for women-initiated technologies. And we come up in discussion with the community, the use of antiretrovirals prophylactically. And in discussions, we find that daily dosing strategies, that was the standard norm for evaluating things, was not appropriate because many of the women who would be using it had migrant partners who they saw 3 or 4 times a year. So they wanted something that they can use around sex. So we go to a coitally linked dosing strategy. And before we, I think, enrolled the first 3 patients, and in the pages of Nature Medicine, so talk about peer review and peer support, we get criticized that this was doomed to failure. In the end, we do find something that works. But I wanted to conclude with this, that if we want the public to appreciate the value of science, then we have to popularize science. We cannot sit in our little offices and wherever it is that we work and think we're doing things to change the world, it is to benefit humanity, and so please tap us on our back, pat us on our backs for a job great, well done. Is that we have to take the populations in our communities with us. And that today we're living in a world where simply providing evidence is not sufficient. The political climate we're living in is very, very challenging, and there's nothing to say that if you produce the best evidence, it will be adopted, whether it's globally or whether it's locally.
And so as scientists, we have additional responsibilities to speak truth to power. And as we're thinking about how do we respond, maybe in narrow ways or in bigger ways, we have this responsibility always to speak truth to power, no matter who is in power. And that is one of our primary responsibilities. Having data to support that truth makes that truth stronger. But we have to take everybody with us in order for that evidence to really realize its true potential and benefit for enhancing the life of all of humanity. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Abdulkarim. I invite Cheku Asakawa to give her view on the topic.
Good morning. So my talk may be more specific and personal, but I hope I can share some challenges in ethics and the importance of ethics for accessibility. So let me introduce myself. When I was born, I was sighted. You can see my picture when I was 1 year old. By the time I was in junior high school, I grew to love sports. People around me thought I could become an Olympic athlete in the future. Then I would be never here. And studying was not my interest. Who knew that one day I might become an IBM fellow? When I was 11 years old, I hit my left eye on the side of a swimming pool. By the age of 14, I was blind. When I became blind, I found there are two difficulties for the blind to live. The first difficulty was to access the information. In those days, no internet, no personal computers, no smartphones. I couldn't read textbooks, newspapers, magazines, any book by myself. Another difficulty was mobility. I couldn't go to school by myself. I couldn't go out for shopping by myself. I couldn't go anywhere by myself. I really wanted to be freed from relying on someone. I wanted to be independent. That became my strong desire, pushed me to ignite innovation. After many twists and turns, I joined IBM Research and started working for accessibility. My first contribution was the development of IBM Homepage Reader. It became the world's first practical voice browser. I received many comments from users. One that I strongly remember said, "Homepage Reader is a window to the world." So it completely changed ways to obtain information resources, from paper to digital. So, you know, I thought, you know, is it going to work? Because the delivery method completely changed from physical mail to the, you know, internet. But society accepted. And now any living disability can get any information through the net. Now my focus is real world. Currently, while exploring a city, I cannot recognize shops around me, products in the shop, if there is a long line, if my friend is approaching me. I can't perceive all these kinds of visual information by myself. And that is my research challenge today. Now, AI technologies start supplementing our visual cognition. We are aiming at supplementing or augmenting missing or weakened cognitive abilities of people with disabilities. It could notify me, traffic lights, crossing, bicycle on the street, escalators, elevators, any information for me to walk by myself. Even now, such technology may tell me the average age of today's audience. If you look excited, happy, bored, or about to fall asleep. It will also supplement weakening cognitive abilities of elderly people. I want to have cognitive assistant to always stay with me to help me understand the real world, real time. As the first step toward realizing the vision, we developed a navigation app, Navigo, which assists blind users to move around indoor locations such as schools, shopping malls, airports, hospitals, and so on. We created a video including this navigation app to show our vision and published it at TED in 2015. So please take a look at the video. I decided to use this video today because it shares some challenges in ethics and some challenges in ethics. Sound doesn't check. Sorry, it seems like I'm the first speaker to use the video today. So this is a good example. I don't know what's going on. So in the future, AI will help me understand what's going on. So, human beings cannot...
So happy.
Oh, well, my paper just got accepted.
Oh, that's good. Great. Congratulations.
Thanks. Wait, how'd you know it was me and that I look happy?
All right.
Oh, hi.
He is not talking to you, but on his phone.
let me show you the latest technologies. This is a smartphone app that we are working on.
51 feet to the door and keep straight. Take the two doors to go out. The door is on your right. Nick is approaching. Looks so happy.
Oh, hi, Nick.
Hey, Jacob.
Where are you going? You look so happy.
Oh, well, my paper just got accepted.
Oh, that's great. Congratulations.
Thanks. Wait, how'd you know it was me and that I look happy?
All right.
Oh, hi.
He is not talking to you, but on his phone. Potato chips. Dark chocolate with almonds. You gained 5 pounds since yesterday. Please take that one instead of chocolate. Approaching. You arrived.
Now, so you could see how useful these technologies are, but you know, when it becomes available or practical, facial recognition, emotion recognition, object recognition, how to deal with personal data, everything is gonna be challenges. Okay, AI Suitcase is the latest project I'm working on. By integrating perception, planning, and control, Suitcase could be a new type of travel companion for me. Please take a look at the video.
Okay.
Take me to the United Kiosk.
Okay, United Kiosk. There is one person in line in front of you.
Hi.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Okay, going to gate A6.
Okay, going to gate A6. Train is here. We are entering the door on the left. Escalator in 5 meters. Escalator approaching. Carry me.
Excuse me.
Flight has been delayed by 3 hours.
And the final issue is not my issue. Okay, so in this way, I really need this suitcase to travel more, work more, and enjoy more. We need AI, and we can make AI evolve. AI has a bright future, but AI should be fair as an assistant for our daily lives. AI is based on data. And data is collected from our society. It means AI is a mirror of diversity of our society. People with disabilities should take an important role in the development process of AI. Accessibility needs ignited various innovations in the history of technology. Telephone was invented while developing a communication tool for hearing impaired in 1800s. You can see many other examples here, but the next big thing is, of course, AI. Accessibility could be a flagship use case for the cutting-edge AI technologies, and it will lead us to the next generation breakthrough invention. AI for accessibility, accessibility for AI. AI will change our everyday lives. People with disabilities will inspire new applications and help AI grow.
we hope to explore the new era with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Checo. Professor Silva is going to conclude our presentations for today.
Thank you. So I don't have PowerPoint slides, which takes away the risk of the technical failure. That's a plus, let's say. First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers and all the panelists for their contributions today. And everyone in the audience for being here, but especially also Professor Asakawa for sharing all these details on the technology and how it's being derived. I think that's a great example on creating more access for everybody. So in terms of the ethical conduct in science, I'd like to break it down in three points. Firstly, it's about the personal conduct in science. Secondly, the institutional conduct that is required. And thirdly, maybe a point that isn't talked often about, the conduct as a customer in science as well. Price awareness is the main thing here. In terms of the personal conduct in science, we need to think about an inner law that is guiding us in terms of ethics. We need to refrain from doing certain things because we have an inner code to do so. One example that I like to think of is, I can leave my laptop somewhere here, I haven't seen it, but I believe no one would steal it because people have an inner code that prevents them from taking it. So it's not so much the fear of punishment, but the inner code that prevents them from engaging in certain behavior. And we need to get to a similar culture in terms of research as well, where we foster independent thinking, for example, within young students, but within like everyone in academia. The culture of speaking out when things go wrong, so we need to implement that directly within people as well, and also that the integrity of science comes first. And what are the means to implement something like that, like this inner code, let's say? So one aspect or one analogy could be maybe the Hippocratic oath as well, that doctors are required to take, do no harm. So that's a guiding principle, irrespective of the institution that they belong to. So my suggestion or some thought experiment here would be to have an academic oath that ties scientists or academics to their profession rather than to an institution. And I was thinking what could be the core principles, and it's difficult to come up with them, but luckily Professor Nutt already came up with some of them. For example, honesty, fairness, objectivism. I mean, these are exactly the kinds of things that can be implemented and that should be already become a part of the formal curriculum, sort of to be drilled into people from the very beginning in order to develop an inner morality. And that brings me to the second point. While it's very important, of course, to have an inner law, it's also important to talk about the institutional conduct as well, an outer law, so to speak. And here it's about like the classic instruments of reward and reprimand, let's say. So we need consistent principles that are being applied, consistent and accountable principles on what happens if misconduct occurs. So the negative ones are well known. So, for example, in terms of publications, when data is falsified, we had some of these cases. There can be a retraction. In the most extreme cases, there was an example in Germany. The PhD was stripped away from someone who conducted later in their careers after the PhD in unethical behavior because, so this was the thinking, they brought shame to the university, to the institution of academia. So these are sort of the negative consequences an institution can take, and we need to think about these instruments very carefully. So to have proportionate and measured response to unethical behavior. But we shouldn't always think in a negative way. It's also about the positive instruments that institutions can provide to researchers. So often researchers and scientists feel left alone. They don't know exactly how to engage with certain situations, and institutions can be very helpful here. By, for example, having external aid, assessing situations that are critical, because very often the help only comes for black and white situations, which are very easy to handle. But we often encounter, because of the changing scientific landscape, gray areas. The data was collected in a certain way, but is it appropriate to publish it? And judging these gray areas are sort of the day-to-day problems that a lot of scientists are facing, not just the black and white cases. And it would be incredibly important to have institutional support here to evaluate these cases more clearly instead of like just having, I mean, acknowledging the grayness would be already a big contribution from the institutions instead of like saying, these are the laws, don't break them. But then, you know, they are subject to interpretation. And this interpretation help would be needed. And ideally, and that's concluding the second point, the institutions need to foster and cultivate a culture where people can behave ethically, where the structure is lending itself naturally to behave ethically, to behave according to the core principles that we need to establish more. Ideally, we would have the inner and the outer law correspond to each other in a kind of like Kantian categoric imperative, where the inner guiding principles that we have would be sufficient to also guide an entire university, for example, or the entire academic system. So matching those two would be the main challenge here. It's a very like a classic German approach to it, let's say, to have the categoric imperative here. So then this brings me to the third point of prize awareness, let's call it. So the hypothesis is here that academics are not tough enough customers. Academics very often don't have a very good price sensitivity. How much should things cost? And I see it when I buy like instrumentations and setups for my own laboratory. I'm not sure what the price should be. And there are two reasons for this. First, it's inexperience. I mean, it's hard to tell because there's not like a centralized marketplace facilitating it often. But the second one is also there's a dynamic of moral hazard here as well. Often it's not the own money that is being spent and therefore it's easier to spend it. I think if we had to pay with our own money, we would be very aware of the price very quickly. But the point that I'm trying to get to is because of the lacking price sensitivity, the supply and demand structure is not fully used that enables, in a free market at least, to reduce the cost significantly. And one very important example are, for example, scientific conferences, which are often not as efficient as they can be, producing huge profit margins. If there was more competition, if academics were demanding lower prices as well, because they are more invested to the money that is being spent, the price in a free market would drop automatically. And this would help everybody, because that funding would free up for the individual research questions. And the second point, and it came up already in the panel discussion, and in the panel contributions as well, is publishing. So publishing is producing a huge amount of profit. There are the library subscription, that's one aspect, but even the publication costs itself are very high. I mean, journals very often receive like fees for publishing in the first place, like a one-off fee, but also they employ writers, like they're not employing them directly, that's exactly the problem, someone else is employing them, so the salary of those who publish articles is paid by someone else, but and the review process at the same time is for free too. So it's a great business actually, a great funnel in a way to privatize money that was initially contributed by the public sphere. And of course, one can say, what can we do about this? You know, it's been like this for 50 or 60 years, and that's true. But still, we need to think about how to deal with this dynamic, because in a free market, again, if we had to pay with our own money these horrendous fees, this concept wouldn't work anymore. So there are profit margins sometimes beyond the double digit here. In a company context, if there was sufficient competition, this price would drop automatically. So this means there's an inefficiency in the publication process. Now we can say, why do we care? Because we are only invested to our research. The problem is the resources that are used to support a system that isn't perfectly efficient are reallocated from our own researchers. So we cannot hire as many PhDs as we want. Maybe we don't get the equipment that we want. We can't invest in other things because we need to invest them in this system that is profiting so much. And that's sort of where we need to try to find a solution. And also as a side note, it affects, of course, developing nations even more so because they don't have access to it and the barrier is even higher. And this is a problem in and out of itself as well. So then what is the solution here or what's something to think about? It's sort of to increase the price awareness as well. And this would be So an overall service to the scientific community as well. What could be the means for this? So one mean could be a group action, for example. So like a more collective way to handle the market. So at the moment, we have the problem that we have a bazaar economy. So we go from one stand to another, asking about the prices, then comparing them with each other in order then to develop the lowest price, which is a very inefficient process. What we need to get to is a supermarket where everything is handled, where there's a price tag, and where the negotiation already occurred in the background. So that's sort of what a collective action would entail if the scientific community was able to get to a collective bargaining power. And it's happening already. For example, with Elsevier, there are like very increased negotiations about this by collectivizing the entire activity of scientists. So the individuals don't need to negotiate by themselves anymore. It happens also in a less legal sphere. For example, Sci-Hub is undermining the whole system at the moment as well. I think that's one of the main reasons that there's so much activity in this field at the moment. Kind of analogous to what happened with Napster and the music industry. So there will be a lot of change coming simply because the technology is driving it. Or, for example, Plan S as well. A lot of the European institutions are subscribing to it. The young academies, both the Global Young Academy and the Young Academy of Germany are very involved here as well, trying to also include the perspective of younger scientists into this as well, how to deal with the publication process and how to lower the overall price as well. And then individually speaking as well, when something is a ripoff, we should point it out more often. Even if it's not our own money, we should have the courage to say, this is a total ripoff. Why are you taking so much money? Because it's taxpayers' money. We should be trying to use it in a responsible way. And pointing out that it's a ripoff is a service to the community in that sense as well. And with these three points, to develop an inner law, to have institutions that are stronger supporting individuals while developing ethical behavior, and by being better deal makers and more frugal customers, I'd like to conclude. Thank you.
Thank you. As we are running late, like 7 minutes or something, I would like to give floor to you if you have questions. I think that we have assistance for the microphone. It's over here.
Hello, I'm Agnes Boros, originally from Hungary. Happy to be back to my home country. Now I work for Genome British Columbia, Canada, where we are funding genomics research and innovation in human health and the life sciences sectors. So when a new technology becomes available, we are finding that laws and regulations usually lag behind, and in some cases, it can take several years to regulate a new technology until when it can often be used for a lot of good things, but some individuals or organizations may use it for things that are unethical but not unlawful due to the lack of regulations. So my question to the expert panel is, what are your views and suggestions on how policymaking could be somewhat accelerated to keep up with the rapid pace of technology development?
Who would like to start?
I think legally or laws cannot keep up with the rapidity with which science is moving. I think we have to accept that. The other thing is, for instance, you're talking about genome. So when we look at it in India, for instance, we know that a law will take a long time because it has to go through the process of parliament, etc. But fortunately for us, the DNA, use of DNA many years ago, the law that was passed finally had very broad connotations, or at least sentences which are very broad, which can cover also the genome editing. So that kind of a thing has been helpful for us. But I think you have to accept that the rapidity with which science is moving ethics and law will always be reactive to the progress rather than be proactive.
Any more questions?
Sorry, I'm Colin Humphreys. I'm the treasurer of the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry. I just wanted to make three suggestions, actually, from points that came up. The first was to do with global peer review, because I would point out that for the last 100 years, our union has had the job of the critical review of chemical data, and all that information is published freely and has been all that time, and I think ISC might want to look at the role of the unions in providing that. The second point was to pick up on this point on capitalization of knowledge. I'm a retired industrial chemist, and quite honestly, as an industrial chemist, I felt very lonely at this science forum. There are not many people here from industry, but I suggest that if you're worried about the pressures, you should actually be talking to industrial chemists, because they have been having to deal with those questions about their own behavior within their companies for years. And the last point was on guidelines. We actually developed and have had adopted ethical guidelines for chemists. These are now the Hague Ethical Guidelines adopted by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, and they are to guide chemists about their behavior ethically in obviously what is a very serious issue, one that hasn't actually been discussed at this meeting. Anyway, just three thoughts, but there is stuff out there and there are people you could be talking to.
We can take just one more question here. And then we have to leave because press is waiting for us. Here are the gentlemen.
While you're waiting for the microphone, I appreciate the comment you made that the commercial people were not represented in this group. I think private companies, particularly biotechnology, would have been very helpful.
Microphone over there. Here for the gentleman.
Is it me? All right. Okay, I wasn't sure. Okay, thank you very much. So I have two questions, and the observational question. My name is Helen Gavigan from Science, People and Politics. One of it is it possible to reach a common definition of the word truth? And I just want to put that on the table. Secondly, for Dr. Hendricks, what information would it help to have if one is a scientist responsible for researching factors impacting food security? Given people need calories and nutritional inputs, and there are many ways of considering and representing geospatial information, and bearing in mind the national security interests of countries. That's
could we take, could you take your question too, and then we'll answer?
Good morning. Thank you for the attracting panel. My name is Hassan Dweck. I'm a chemist from Al Quds University in Palestine. Actually, I have a remark when it comes to integrity in scientific research, honesty. I think education is very important, because either you are ethical or non-ethical when it comes to doing your research at the university level or an institution. So I think we have to start taking care of kids at school, educating them about the role of scientific research, the role of being very honest and to do your integrity while you are doing scientific research. I believe that it must be a must. Thank you.
Okay. Professor Hendricks, would you like to answer the question?
Thank you. The whole area of food security is incredibly complex and requires transdisciplinary approaches. You need data right across the food system, from food production through to trade flows to human nutrition. There is no gold standard for measuring it, and so we have to use a variety of different indicators. And in order to interpret those indicators, you need the people around the table who have the scientific knowledge to interpret them. Ultimately, we have to arrive at a consensus through negotiation and discussion of those particular indicators. And so it makes it very complex to do in terms of a database approach.
Thank you. Thank you all for listening to us, and thank you to all of my speakers. We need to go to the press conference now. Thank you.